that was like game changing for me, that like, oh, I have something to say, right? And so it's like, how do we create those experiences for young people where they recognize that their voice is valuable, that it can be impactful, that their ideas matter, that their anger matters, right?
That is the voice of Elisa Burden, co-founder of Real World Scholars, a company based here in San Diego that seeks to provide students with the opportunity to become young entrepreneurs. Imagine, if you will, a company that will provide you seed money and a place to house your money in a way that you can access it without all of the red tape that comes with district controlled funds. Sound too good to be true? Well, it isn't, because it's already occurring in hundreds of schools across the United States, and you're going to hear Elise talk about it on this episode here, episode 26 of the Educated Guest Podcast. You know how Rodrigo and I do it. We puts the fun in dysfunctional. We get into her history as a learner and as a young student and what prompted her to get started in the educational space she's in now. Let's get it.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to the Educated Guest Podcast.
That's right. That's right. In the house today with us, we have Elise Burden. Say what's up. Say what's up.
What's up?
And we want to start this
as weird as possible.
The mic check work
won't make it on the podcast. Edit that part out right there on the floor.
On the editing floor.
Welcome. Welcome to the Educated Guest Podcast. We have a special guest with us.
Miss Elise Burden of the Real World Scholars.
That's right. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
And you know what? Before we get into you and what you're about, we want to just start right in with Real World Scholars and what it is that you have to offer to students in school districts. So jump right in with us.
But before we even go there, we got to start with the disclaimer. Go ahead, Caesar.
All right. So the opinions contained herein belong to ourselves and our guests, and in no way, shape, or form do they reflect upon our district or any of the associations that we work for. Now, having said that,
let's talk some shit.
I was going to say, my opinions 100% represent my organization.
Right, right. And just to throw this out there, the Educated Guest Podcast is looking for sponsorship, people that do align with our interests and our opinions. Yeah. So at any rate.
That's the soft pitch.
That's right. Elise, tell us about Real World Scholars and what it is that you guys offer.
Oh, good question. So we are a nonprofit. We're based here in San Diego, but we work with classrooms all around the country to really infuse hands-on, real-world entrepreneurial learning experiences. And so to take a step back, a lot of folks say, great, cool, you do entrepreneurial education. And that just honestly couldn't be further from the truth, because ultimately what we're really trying to do is just reimagine what learning looks like through an entrepreneurial lens, understanding that like every young person is going to need to have like an entrepreneurial posture to be them best selves, be their best selves, and really like achieve success, whatever that looks like for them. And so what that looks like in reality in our programming is that we partner with classrooms, we provide dollars, we provide a tech platform, and we provide some support materials and often personalized support to help classes run student-run businesses. Am I allowed to cuss here?
Absolutely. Okay. We encourage you.
Oh, good. Okay. So a few, maybe like a month ago, it was like lots of meet and greets and explaining the work. And I met someone around like 10 o'clock at night and like, so what it is that you do? And I started like, well, we support classrooms. And then I was like, oh, fuck. We just like give space for kids to be whoever they want to be, like whoever the fuck they want to be. And she was just like, oh, cool. That makes sense. Right. Ultimately, that's what we're here for, is like to give, you'll hear me talk about like space and grace for young people to like get their ideas and their work and their voice out into the world in meaningful ways that can affect their communities, and have like an authentic learning experience that allows them to like grow and evolve and iterate in that space, while A, providing value to their communities, and B, like, cultivating their own skills and interests.
So we're not talking about sweatshops here, right? We're talking about
like a little sweatshoppy.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. So right. First off, you're talking about providing money and you're talking about providing support and entrepreneurship. So let's go into those one by one.
Okay, so I'll just start like real basic. All of our classrooms run EdCorps, education corporations. They're student-run businesses that operate under our organizational umbrella so that teachers don't have to worry about scary things like sales tax and business licenses. We take care of all that stuff. And so all of these classes, they get, some curricular materials. They get access to our community. We have like kind of specialized account managers who help them start a business in their classroom. And oftentimes what this looks like is businesses that align with the core curriculum of that class. So for example, we piloted in a chemistry class and they had a soap project that helped them learn about certain chemical reactions. And rather than just having that soap project, they turned it into a soap making business, right? So art classes can run art galleries, English classes can run publishing companies. The list is so long and varied, and kids get more and more creative each year. But oftentimes it's a way for them to like learn the core content that they already had to learn, but like with a more authentic audience and real stakes. You know, one of my favorite student quotes, I say it all the time, I wish we could put it on our website. We asked a kid, like, how has running an education corporation changed your classroom experience? And he said, like, well, I used to not give a shit about my work, but now that people are paying me a lot of money for it, I guess I actually have to work hard.
Yes.
And so, yeah, so we work with the educator to figure out, like, what are their unique educational goals. For some of our teachers, it's like, I really want them to be creating relationships with people in the community that are, you know, mentor like. For other teachers, it's like, we really want, you know, them to understand, you know, why they're learning certain, you know, like relevance, right? So depending on what the educational goals are for the educator and the environment and what they're looking to do, we kind of help curate an experience that helps them accomplish those.
Okay, so then, you know, a lot of questions for the listeners obviously here. So like, if there's a problem with the product, you know, so for instance, the soap.
Mm-hmm.
If it gives out rashes or whatever.
If it burns the skin. Mm-hmm. So who deals with these kinds of problems with products?
So in the short term, the students do. It's funny, when we first got started, and we still hear this sometimes, teachers are like, well, what happens if like something goes wrong? And I'm like, they learn. Welcome, right? We have a teacher. This class actually got a little sweatshoppy. The teacher had to like start sending her kids home because they were so excited. They were doing. It's an engineering class, and they make these cherry wood coasters. And she had to be like, "It's 9 o'clock. Legally, you're no longer allowed to be on campus. Like, you have to go home." Yeah. But they were like super stoked about it. And so they do a bunch of kind of like signage and things like that. But they also were doing refurbishing of things. And so someone brought in like an old family like heirloom furniture set, like a bed set and dresser, and they fixed it. And then she's like, "Well, you know, why don't you paint it?" And they didn't have the exact color, and so they just like did another color. Like a similar color. And then it didn't match this like antique set. And it was like a big fuck up, right? Mm-hmm. But like, then they had to figure that out. Then they had to, like, that is an amazing skill set to have to learn, where you have to like go look someone in the eye and say, like, I have like let you down in a way that's like pretty tough for you to hear. Like, this is not just like, oh, like I got the wrong color. It's like, it's a family heirloom. But like, the teacher talked about how the learning experience of them having to like make that right was, you know, far more valuable than the actual engineering competencies that went into that, you know? And of course, she was bummed, but they went above and beyond to fix it. And then they did a bunch of other cool work for her, and just the interpersonal skills that they learned through that, you know, dealing with that problem, that mistake. Was awesome. So in the short term, to answer that question, the kids do. And we actually encourage that all the time.
What about with the tough problems, though? Like, I'm going to sue your ass for this product.
Yeah, so that's why when they operate under our umbrella, we can kind of take care of those things. So we haven't been sued. I'm keeping my fingers tightly. Yeah, knock on this fake-ass wood. But we kind of take care of some of those things, and how we deal with customers and the things that they kind of sign off on when they're purchasing from student-run businesses, acknowledging that they are, this is, you know, this is soap made by students. It's probably going to be fine, but if it's not, you've acknowledged that you are buying soap made by students.
Right. And that's in the purchasing part of all this.
Yep.
Stuff, right. What about the handling of money? Like, that seems like it would be, I know we've had a couple of teachers go like, I don't know, it's kind of weird, what's gonna happen, they're gonna steal all of our money,
or worse than that, how do we, not worse than that, but more troubling than that, is how do we make money on a school campus when there's so many rules with ASBs and what can be done?
Yeah, so the first, I met my co-founder at the end of 2013. All of 2014, we spent having these conversations with educators, like hundreds and hundreds of educators. We talked to them about like entrepreneurship. What do you think about entrepreneurship in the classroom? Have you ever run a student-run business? And that was a theme that we heard over and over again. It was like, well, this sounds interesting, or I really wanted to do this, or even I tried to do this and it went so poorly because of the ASB or the district or whatever. And so when we were developing this platform, it was 100% with these pain points in mind. And that's one of the reasons we host the banking. So one of the reasons we built a technology platform, you know, for the students to build e-commerce businesses, it's like, of course, Shopify exists, Wix exists, like there's a million platforms that already exist that they could use. But doing that would require them to hook up their own bank account. And then there's this question of like, so is it the teacher's bank account? Is it the school's bank account? Like, who gets to, you know? And that's when it becomes just a total mess. And so having our own technology that backs into our bank accounts allows each student-run business to run all of their dollars through our accounts. And so what's been interesting is that, like, and I think this is always the case when you're innovating, is that like, there are not a lot of rules. A lot of the districts we work with say, like, well, this doesn't technically violate the rules because we don't have any rules Correct. That should pertain to this. Like, we don't know how to even treat a program like this. And so a lot of them have, you know, hesitantly but, like, boldly said, okay, like, let's just give it a shot. And it just keeps it safer. It's easier. You know, they can take credit card sales online. A lot of them have, you know, PayPal readers. All those dollars go right in their account. And then they just tell us where to send it. So, you know, if your student-run business has made $4,000, and you say, you know, we want $2,000 to come back for supplies and $2,000 to go to a local homeless shelter that we're working with. We handle those funds pretty quickly and pretty easily, and you don't have to touch that cash or have your name attached to it. It doesn't have to run through an ASB.
Does it need to be voted upon by students and all that stuff?
No.
And it was documented minutes?
It was a really important thing for us that, like, everyone got to make their own choices.
That's rad.
And so sometimes we see, like, so we fund through a platform called Class Wallet. They're a great partner of ours. It was started by the founder of Adopt a Classroom. He raised, you know, millions of dollars, or the organization raised millions of dollars for teachers. And he was like, wait a minute, this isn't working. Like, there's so much red tape that, like, the impact isn't felt the way it should be. And so with Class Wallet, it just makes it super easy for donors to put dollars into digital wallets for educators, and then they can spend it accordingly. And so we fund through that platform because we like the open-handedness of it, right? Like, I want, you know, the dollars to go into your account, and then you and your students to figure out how to spend those dollars for whatever your goals are, right? Because that's the beauty of an entrepreneurial platform, is that, like, it could be we need all hard materials. Maybe it's a, you know, a marketing, you know, swag. Whatever you want to do with that is totally up to you. Mm-hmm. And there are times we can see all – that's the beautiful thing about Class Wallet, is that it's, like, totally transparent. So we can see how people are spending money. And there are times we're like, you spent how much money on tape? Oh, okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. I hope that works out. Can't imagine where this is going, but, you know, but that's the thing. It's like, well, if the students have decided, like, that's what they think is, like, the best usage of those dollars, we want them to get out there and figure it out.
Yo, so tell me this, Elise. So how many cities and how many schools roughly are Real World Scholars
helping? So many. well, it's less bragging, more like how many cities that I've been to in the last 3 years. And I counted recently, and it was a lot. It was somewhere between, like, 35 and 40. So we are currently in 34 states. Mm-hmm. This year, I don't know, we're about to actually onboard a new cohort in January. And with those numbers, I think we'll be around 270 classrooms throughout the K-12 spectrum. They're selling products, services, everything. You know, there's a bike repair shop is opening at High Tech High soon. Yeah. Yeah. So, like, there's all sorts of different project types that are happening. Lots of, like, hydroponics and composting and all sorts of wild stuff.
Hydroponics. Interesting. Now, you said that, like, I remember a few weeks ago we had a conversation about the popularity of the entrepreneurship in the Rust Belt.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
So cool. So, you know, I'm a coastal person. I am an LA native, right? I did not grow up giving a lot of time to the folks in the middle, which is awful. It's an awful thing to admit, but I'm owning it here now and asking for penance. So some of our favorite communities that we work with are the ones in the middle. They're the ones that are gritty and thirsty, and they're small enough to, like, actually care about one another and, like, put that care to work, right? And so one of our favorite cities is Kansas City. And it has been amazing working there because you call one person and say, hey, we've got an opportunity. They say, great, I know 10 people. And this happens all the time, right? People always, you know, you talk about money and exciting learning outcomes for students. People always are excited at first, but then they actually, like, we work with this amazing, just a beast of a human, Laura Gilchrist, and she's like sending, the day I reached out to her, it's like midnight Kansas City, and she's firing off like a dozen emails that are like novel emails to teachers introducing me, like, hey, this is Elise, you should meet her. Hey, you know, and I'm like, are you on my coast? Because it's late as hell on my coast, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so, but they know each other and they want to support each other. And it was both, she wanted to help me recruit in the Kansas City area, but she was also like, I want this for my city, and I know everyone in my city. And they have that social connectivity where they do learn together, they do grow together. And so, one of the things, so Kansas City comes to mind. Chattanooga has been another amazing town to work in. And I don't know what it is. I just realized it really in the last like 6 months. It was like, I'm seeing a pattern here of the cities that are really taking this and running with it as a community. We have exciting things happening in San Diego and Boston, whatever. But as a community taking this and running with it, you know, we're seeing it happen in places like Pittsburgh. And there's something about, I think, the size and kind of like the culture outside of education. Because those are places where, you know, the entrepreneurial communities are really, they're grinding and they're clawing for their space. in a really positive way. And I think when we can start to think about what it looks like to dissolve the walls between that and education, and all they're doing is inviting young people into that space, yep. and magic is happening. Yeah, it's so cool. It's so cool. Like, I just want to work with like only like 250,000 person cities of nice people. Like, there's something there. I don't know what it is.
There is. I think that's kind of, and there's lessons to be learned there from the smaller cities in the Rust Belt that big cities or small communities in big cities can take and learn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So give me a little bit of history on Real World Scholars, how long you've been in operation, and how'd the idea come about?
Yeah, good question. So I met my co-founder at the end of 2013. We couldn't be more different. I had just moved down from LA and like burnt out on a corporate philanthropy job. I was looking like super chill for a bit. And he was this like wily, he is this like wily entrepreneur who like has way too many ideas than he can actually put to use. And so when he met me, he had a wily idea. He said, like, I want to give money to kids to practice entrepreneurship. It was really important for him, you know, because he didn't do well in traditional education space. And he only really started figuring out what he was good at and his own skill set when he started selling encyclopedias door to door. And so he said, I don't know what it is, but I know that there's something about kids getting out of the building and like having to go talk to people, having to like sell their ideas and like iterate, right? Because sales, door-to-door sales, it's like, great, that didn't happen. What are you going to do? You have 20 feet to figure out like your next strategy, right? And so there was something really formative for him about that and wanted to recreate that learning experience for other kids. So we just started looking around. Like, we probably spent the first year researching, and it was everything from like just, you know, and he's a master researcher. Like, he gets caught up on an idea, and like within like 2 hours, he's sending me like 45 links of articles to read. It's really wild. I actually have a spreadsheet of just like things I need to catch up on, like like links. But we spent the first year researching, talking to educators, going to conferences, and literally just having like a bunch of bad ideas. Okay, money in the hands of kids. We know ASB is an issue. So what if we did a program like this? And people would say, yes, 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 no. That's really great, but this is really dumb, yeah, right? Yeah. And we just probably came up with about a half a dozen ideas that we kind of like took to market, like full websites built, press release type stuff, and that just didn't go anywhere because we got them out. And then people said, like, that's kind of in the right direction, but these are the ways that it needs to grow and evolve. And so over the course of that year, we were able to identify a couple big pain points. The money obviously was one of them. The idea of like customers, right? Like, not every person lives in a city like San Diego where there's people everywhere, right? Like, we have rural communities. You have we didn't want teachers to have to like pack all this shit on their back every weekend and take their kids to farmers markets in order to run this. So it was like, how can we reach customers without leaving our classroom? Because there's going to be a lot of constraints around that. So that was a big piece of it. And then obviously it was just like, I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't know what to do. And so there was clear that they needed support and like handholding and coaching. And so that when we thought about those three things, that's where we ended up like building a platform. And actually how it really started was that whole year, like I said, it was like a lot of conversations. And we happened to be at a conversation at USD with Katie Martin and Karen Cater from Digital Promise and a couple of other folks. And it was just like the newest iteration of the idea. Like, what if we had like an e-commerce site that did this and this and this? And you know, they gave us some really great critical feedback. But at the end of it, Katie Martin said, like, well, but would you be willing to try it in a chemistry class? And like, to date, people were looking at us like we had a third eye. It was like, yeah, that's cool. But like, what are you really talking about? Mm-hmm. Again, people were kind of putting us in the entrepreneurial education bucket, which is, we knew early on that this needed to be something for all kids. All students need to have access to these types of opportunities. And so having a person say, like, that's a cool idea, would you be willing to try it? We just said yes. We had no idea what it meant. I'm not an educator. My partner is definitely not an educator. And within a week, we met her husband, who happened to be a chemistry teacher, 10th grade chemistry teacher at High Tech High. And she said, he has a soap project. Could we make this a soap business? And we said, yeah, because you say yes and you figure out how after the fact. And we spent that first semester, I don't even know what year that was. It probably would have been January of 2015 was when we were with him, maybe.
Were you guys stealing fat from the hospital?
How did you know? yeah.
Were you guys doing that or the kids?
We let the kids harvest it because you have to learn by doing, Caesar.
You have to steal everything. Kids steal everything.
What I think is important, though, is the process that you went to build Real World Scholars is a larger version of what you expect these kids to do when they're thinking about something to sell and they're trying to build a business,
right? Totally. And that's the thing that's like really cool about the work is that like in the same way, I mean, I think we all say this to kids, like, oh, we're doing the same thing. It's all, you know, but like, but we really are. Mm-hmm. And when we find tools that we think are cool for our organization, we shoot it out to our community. Like, hey guys, we just found this amazing project management tool. You should check out. Or this is, you know, we oftentimes do kind of transpose our own thinking, our own processes into like, well, what does this look like for young people? What could this look like in the classroom? How do we put this into frameworks that can be used? And what's beautiful is, and I think this has been really empowering for the educators that we work with, is that like, we fall on our face all the time, like all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of public about it because we ship an idea out and we're like, oh shit, just kidding, that wasn't right. But it'll be better next time, we promise, we'll get back to it, right? Yeah. So I think it really has set the tone for the students that we work with and the educators that we work with, and letting them know that, like, you know, a bias towards that experimentation, a bias towards action, is really what the learning is about, you know? And a lot of times it's like, well, the sales, like, what if our business isn't successful? And we're like, if you are doing things, I don't care if your kids don't sell a single thing. If they kept trying, like, if they tried all year long and didn't sell a damn thing, they probably learned a lot. Like, if they were actually throwing themselves into that, you know, that experimentation. One of our favorite stories was a freshman class in Albany a few years ago. They're going to do compact compost bins. They wanted to make composting more accessible for folks living in urban spaces. And I thought it was an amazing idea. They were prototyping. It was only supposed to be a quarter-long project, but they ran into so many roadblocks. Like, they it smells, it leaks, it's burnt, you know,
can't
whatever.
That should be combustible, too?
Probably. I'm not a scientist. Mind blown. But it was supposed to be a quarter-long project, but they ended up spending the entire year doing it because they just couldn't get it right. And it was like, great, like, now we need to go talk to a professional who knows about, you know, decomposition to help us figure out, like, why are the worms dying? Why does it smell so bad? How do we fix these things? And so they kept having to go back to the drawing board. It was beautiful. And at the end of it, they had, like, two compost bins that were, like, actually sellable. But, like, we thought that was like the biggest success. They made like $150, but like the teacher said, they had to go way deeper into their actual content matter to figure out like scientifically what was happening, and the kids understood it so much better, and they were so much more attached to the idea, and so much more detached from a fear of failure, because they're like, oh well, if I screwed it up, then I guess we got to go back to, you know, you get so used to going back to the drawing board that it's not as scary anymore to like not get the right answer.
So you bring me to a question though. So they only sold two for like $150. What happens with the seed money, though, that you provide like $1,000 to each school? So what happens if they end up taking an L?
They don't have to pay it back. No one has to pay any of the money back. That would be so stressful. Yeah. This isn't supposed to be stressful.
Yeah.
I mean, in saying that, you know, it's not like we're like, hey, just come blow the money. It'll be fun. Exactly. But you know, we're intentional with the educators that we work with. And, you know, if they don't, we really want it to be like an empowering and liberating experience for them. Mm-hmm. And so if I can do that for $1,000 or potentially even less, right, we're kind of starting to think through how can we support more educators. Some of our teachers don't even use $1,000. They use $300. Great. Like, the more we can get that, even just like the buy-in, I think there is so much that happens when teachers know that we're willing to invest in them and we're not going to micromanage them. We're not going to come for that money. We trust them. We believe in them. I think just that can be like, you know, super fuel.
Ooh.
Is that right? I'm bad at idioms. So that's actually how I should have introduced myself. My name is Elise and I'm bad at idioms. And so I pretty regularly say things that are not. My team actually just told me that hurting penguins is not a thing.
Have not heard of that one.
No,
but can you visualize? Can't you visualize? Like penguins are just bumping into each other, trying to hurt them sounds hard. Apparently it's hurting cats.
Hurting. Hurting cats.
Not hurt. Did you hear H-U-R-T?
I did.
Oh, wow.
I did.
That's dark. It's really dark.
That's why that's getting on the editing floor.
Apparently, so beating penguins up is not a thing.
All right, now that the penguin situation has been diffused, let's take a short break, go over the broad strokes of what Real World Scholars does. They'll provide you with up to $1,000 in seed money and the support, the personal support of an e-commerce website and an e-wallet where you can easily and quickly get your funds without all the red tape that comes with a district ASB. So at any rate, let's get back up into this interview. Hope you're enjoying this episode 26, Elise Burden. Come on.
You have to think about this. Is actually, so if you can name the song and the artist and hit us up on Twitter, we'll get you shirts.
Damn.
It just makes you feel good.
This almost sounds like Angela Bofield.
No. Nah.
Oh, I mean, but she's like from like the 70s, so it's for sure not. It just sounds like.
Oh, shit.
Just play the sample version.
I will.
Just fuck with it. Let's go. Get into it.
There it is.
You can't see the dance party happening, but do know that it is in fact happening.
Welcome back to the Educated Guest Podcast. We are here with Elise Burden of Real World Scholars, and we talked a bit about the organization and how it can help your classroom, your students. But we want to get a little deeper right here.
Where are we going? Let's try to figure out. Who is Elise?
Mm. When you know. Find out, you should let me know.
Elise. Nah, so we just want to know, one of the cool things that we do in this podcast is find out who are the influential educators in your life, who shaped you, that kind of stuff. And it doesn't even have to be like a teacher or a formal setting, like just what shaped your experience, because everybody's narrative is different, and everybody's outlook is different, and the way, I mean, you're doing amazing work. We want to know what is the genesis of that amazing work. What helped create that?
Oh, I should just start to just dive right
just
into
dive
that.
Dive right in.
Mm-hmm. Well, you kind of asked me this a little bit earlier, and I don't have like a super easy, you know, packaged up answer to that. You know, I can definitely think of educators who changed the game for me, both as a young person and an older young person. You know, I think. I am super honest about the fact that the work that I do here, I'm like genuinely unqualified to do. So I'm like constantly learning. It's really strange sometimes that, like, you know, I can have like a bowl of cereal at 9 p.m. for dinner and think to myself like that I also, like, 4 hours ago I was like running an organization, right? And so I really lean into that, knowing that that while we should all be learning, like, I need to be very postured towards better understanding all aspects of the work, because we do kind of sit in a centrally located spot. And so I'm constantly learning from the teachers we work with, the education adjacent folks that we work with. So I think for me, the work that we do currently stems directly from my own upbringing and a tension that I've been able to identify between, like, on the one hand, knowing that, like, life is just tough. It's tough for a lot of people, right? Yeah. That there are some awful things happening that don't necessarily need to be happening, right? Like, poverty is like a man-made illness, right? So, and there's a whole long list of those things. So, like, both grappling with, like, the reality that this is fucked, right? And also, in all of these wonderful ways in my upbringing, being told that, like, I was valuable enough and smart enough that I could do something about it. And I think that for me, that cross section, and I think that was like educators who told me that. I still remember my favorite educator. I babysat his kids. He had the coolest wife ever. It was like a rad family. He was so smart. And I remember I wrote a paper my junior year about 1984, and I had like a really weird idea about it, and I like presented it, and he was just like, whether it was like the game, the show that he put on for me in that moment or not, but he was like, I've never heard someone like think about it that way. That's so interesting. Like, we're going to have to talk more about that later. And I felt like I basically like I don't even need college. My really smart English, you know, teacher in the 11th grade told me that my ideas were really good and that I should, like, you know, do something with them. And so I think his name is Mr. McBride, by the way, just because I think.
Shout out Mr. McBride.
Brian McBride in Alabama High School. But I think there was a lot of voices for me early on that said, like, go, 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 right? And so grappling with that intersection of, like, wow, the world's really awful. And also, like, I may be, like, I think that I can do something about it, right, for whatever reason, I think has, like, led me now to the space where I'm like, oh, great, like, let's put those things to use. And then, like, in the same way that you kind of articulated that the work that we do as like as an individual is the same work that we're trying to get our students to do as learning processes, I think I'm now uniquely or newly maybe aware of the fact that, like, not every young person does get that message. Mm. And that we all can do something about it. So what does it look like to create space to ask a kid, what do you care about? What makes you angry? Let's do something about that. Because on the one hand, you know, the work that we do now is like great, you know, some commodity-based product that's going to teach them things along the way. But like some of our classes are really, like the students are really asking themselves these questions. Like what is really like hurting our community? And what can we do to help this? You know, Dan Ryder, one of the things, his class was printing fidget spinners before fidget spinners were cool. Right. And I know, what's up, Dan?
Wicked Decent.
That's right. That's right. But where it came from for them was they were like, social anxiety is a big problem on campus. And they'd done like a bunch of like kind of design thinking, empathy mapping, and really identifying that they felt like anxiety on campus was a big problem. This was like their best attempt in the moment to like start to address that. And whether or not that was effective or is effective, I can't speak to that. But the fact that young people are looking around and saying like, what's hurting? How can we help? Right. I think giving people those experiences in the same way that like, you know, by how the stars aligned for me, that was something that was kind of a theme, a narrative in my life for a long time. I now am like fiercely committed to creating space for all young people to have that conversation and all young people to have those types of experiences that encourage them and push them down. You know, like I grew up in a evangelical church, and it was this always shocks people. But like when I was like 15, they're like, do you want to preach? Do you want a microphone? We really want to hear what you have to say. And that was like game changing for me, that like, oh, I have something to say, right? And so it's like, how do we create those experiences for young people where they recognize that their voice is valuable, that it can be impactful, that their ideas matter, that their anger matters, right? So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that tension is something that still drives me today. It's like a fierce optimism and like a very honest, critical look at like what we've got going on. You know, like we can do so much better. And also in the meantime, like kids, people, human beings are hurting every day. And so we have to like channel those things, channel that optimism, channel those talents into like creating spaces so that doesn't have to be the case. And that we can all be activated problem solvers.
It sounds like you had a milestone around that high school time with Mr. McBride. And then I imagine you had something, we talked about it a little earlier, at Pepperdine, you had an experience that was unique, correct?
It also just sounds like she's just hardwired towards human beings and just, you know, people not doing well and what's wrong.
Yeah, I was a big feeler as a kid. Like, I got, like, spanked twice, which in my family is, like, a real outlier. But it was because I would just start crying and apologizing. I'm like, I'm so sorry that I let you down. Like I'd get sad when like other kids were getting bullied. Like I just had like a lot of feelings. Which is funny because my nephew now is like 100%. He's like, did you see that butterfly? I think its wing is a little bit broke. Should we do something? You know, sweet awesome. Baby child. And so, yeah, I think I am kind of oriented towards people, and suffering of sorts. And I don't know if I had like one big, like kind of watershed moment both in high school. Cause I mean, I, you know, there's like, you know, if you see videos of me from a young child, like I always thought my voice was important.
Lisa's always talking.
Oh my gosh. Jesus. A million. My poor parents. Well, it's funny. So I have a niece and nephew. They're 8 and 10 and they're living with me for the year. And karma is a funny thing because I, from the fourth grade on through high school, I woke up at 5 o'clock every day to do my homework in the morning. I'm a morning person. And I'd wake up and I'd start drinking coffee when I was like in the fourth grade. And yeah. Yep. And I was like, I know, apparently it's troubling. So I now in my current life, you know, adjusting to life with kids is tough, especially when I've gone from working like an 80-hour week to like not an 80-hour week. So I, you know, I still wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning and that's when I get some of my work done before the kids get up. But now they also get up and my nephew gets up and starts talking to me at 5 in the morning about nothing
it's
at all.
Super relevant to him, so pump your brakes.
I know, that's the thing. Well, and that's the thing I think about, like, if I don't listen now when the things that I do want to talk about, like, he's not going to talk to me, right? But it's literally like at 5:03, like, hey Tita, you want to see how long I can hold my breath? Like,
of course I do.
Please sign me up. But yeah, you know, it's like it's what's funny is that like, you know, my parents just like look at this and just like grin because they're like, ain't life funny, you know? Karma's a real bitch. But yeah, so I think for me, and again, it makes me feel guilty maybe or self-conscious of the fact that like over the course of my life I had a lot of people saying like go and like I'm so aware now. I mean, I think I was aware at the time, but like I'm so aware now how atypical that is, right? That like having, you know, in the church I grew up in like every social setting I was like, she's got great leadership skills, right? Like and I think all those things have like created the human that I am today, where for no good reason you're like, hey, at least can you do this thing? I'm like, probably I could probably figure it out, right? Like I have that confidence to know that I can problem solve. That's like that creative confidence, right? And that agency. And I think it was just like a lot of small things over the course of the years, which I'm like, you know, wildly grateful for, because I think you can see the opposite side happen too, right? Where it's like, like, did you need something, kid? Right? Like, are you doing that you're thing so again? Needy. You're so needy. You talk so much, right? And so,
go sit in the corner.
You require so much attention in my space.
Yeah. What do you need?
What a jerk. I love how those come so easily off the tip of your tongue, Caesar.
It's almost like you've practiced. Is that muscle memory that we see?
Shit.
Damn.
It's called sarcasm, guys.
Oh, okay, cool.
I'm well versed. I have much to offer.
So I don't know whether we want to go, because this is something that we haven't talked about, and I know this because
keep your shirt on, Rodrigo.
Easy.
Things are escalating.
Yeah, right. Things are escalating. It's getting warm in here. You were recently acknowledged by a very, very amazing organization.
Yeah, it's funny.
Do you want to share that? Or do you want me to share it and make it super awkward? Or what do you want
I
to do?
I will, if that is the pitch, Roderick, I will vote for the lesser awkward one. Sure, I can do that. So in November, I was included on the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for education.
Woo!
Yep, that's a thing.
Yeah, that is not a joke. We are
what's funny, though, is that...
amongst greatness. Make some noise, people.
I'm literally wearing a dirty hoodie right now. Yeah, it was funny because I did make jokes.
It does. White tail, I don't know what that means.
I don't either,
it's
actually.
Going on the Twitters? Sure.
I don't know what it means. I stole it from someone years ago. But I, so I was included on the list. It's a wild world. I there's not a lot to say about it, right? It's just kind of surreal.
I don't read Forbes, so what is 30 under 30?
So they come out with a 30 under 30 list every year, and they pick them by industries. So there's a 30, there's 20 lists, fashion, VC, like sports, like there's, and so it's everything from like, you know, there's like a celebrity one where, you know, who's on, I don't even remember.
Game changers and industry makers.
That's right. Okay. Thanks, Rodrigo. You saved me.
There's 30 of them. But they're under 30 years.
That's right.
I appreciate you providing.
Thank you.
Job number two for Rodrigo on Educating This
yes.
Podcast.
Yes. Finishing sentences when I can't. Yeah. So, so the education list has 20 other human beings. 20? 30? Damn, I had one job. I had one job. Life is hard. There you go. Why are you trying to take everything from me?
All I wanted to say was, dude, that's not like...
It's wild. It's wild.
There's not a whole lot of people that you will meet that are awarded that honor.
I should say this. It's really like, I know this is like the thing, like the politically correct thing that you're supposed to say, but it's actually true. Like they're like, oh, Elise co-founded Real World Scholars. Look at all things Real World Scholars does. But I am not Real World Scholars. I have a team of people who do this work and they're amazing. I often call myself the intern on our team because they're telling me like where to go and how I've screwed things up and like, and they always have better ideas than I have, right? And so like, on the one hand, it's obviously a huge honor. On the other hand, it's like, this is not really my honor. This like belongs to my team of people. Like I was just talking about a team member who I get like Slack messages from all night long. And it's not because he's like working on deliverables. He's just dreaming. He's just like asking hard questions and dreaming. Like having those types of people on your team will take you so much further than great college, you know, or even going it alone. And that's a big entrepreneurial myth, right? Is that like you bootstraps, you do this alone, like the lone wolf, right? But like I have an amazing team. I have an amazing co-founder, like... And so it doesn't really feel like, it feels unfair. I think
those are the most important words that you probably could have said about the issue, because there's a really big misconception that, yes, this whole bootstrapping idea of, it's going to work out, don't worry about it, just do it yourself, work harder, spend more time doing it.
You're baiting me right now. I know you're baiting me, because you know I have such strong feelings about this.
And so, I mean, speaking about that, I mean, so it's awesome on the one hand that you recognize that it's not just you. That's a huge testament to your team and your other co-founder. So that's amazing. But the other piece is that there is this farce about working harder and just bootstrapping it and the quote-unquote hustle that I know that you are super allergic to.
Yeah. Can you speak a little bit to that? Well, yes. I got to frame this because, like, ultimately, like, we're all about the hustle, right? Like, I don't take a ton of time off. In saying that, I think there is something problematic about, like, glorifying the hustle. And again, this is there's probably context that's important here. I'll just put it out there. I have a really hard time when we look at, like, folks who come from particular backgrounds or who end up in a space and there's this, like, glorification of busy. There's this glorification of, like, of achievement. Like I, you know, you get in entrepreneurial circles and it's just like, oh, like, how many hours a week? I haven't even slept this week. You know, and it's something that we're bragging about that we can't take care of ourselves.
Fetishizing that.
100%. And it's just, it's bullshit because at the end of the day, like, I'm really about, like, whole human beings. Wholeness is a big kind of, like, spiritual tenet for me, is that we should all be, like, you know, working for the wholeness of ourselves and our communities, right? Working that long, like I work these crazy hours and I'm constantly having this conversation with myself about balance and harmony and health and people, right? And I think you lose perspective when you don't rest, when you don't take care of yourself, and I know balance is also kind of a loaded word, but like when we're not being realistic about what we need as humans to survive, and I everyone is different and I really want to leave space for that. But like ultimately, like this idea that like you're just going to go until you make it. Like there's something about that posture that is insatiable and you will run yourself into the ground. And, you know, this is when the work that I'm about, I love novel things and cool ideas, whatever. But like the work that I'm about is like really about like systemic wounds and issues and infrastructure that hurts people. It's going to be a long time before we fix that, right? Like this is a marathon. This is not a sprint. And so, and a lot of the folks who are doing this work, who come from certain backgrounds, certain marginalized populations, these, you know, a lot of people are already tired. Yeah. They're already hustling, right? And then they're not going to be the next Gary Vee. They're just working two or three jobs, right? Or they've come into spaces like education because they had a challenging upbringing themselves, or they come from a poorly run education system and want to do something better. And so this idea that like then they're supposed to come to the table already tired, already a bit depleted or whatever, and then just double down until they're dead, right? Just run yourself into the ground because you're going to get there eventually. Like, I don't think that feeling of like make it ever actually comes. Being in an entrepreneurial space, like you're never going to be like, okay, cool. Like if you've gotten used to grinding 80 hours a week, there's no spot like time where you're like, all right, I'm good now. You're always going to feel that need, and I think it can be disorienting, and I think you lose clarity. And then for those of us doing this work, I think you know you got to pace yourself because the clarity piece is important, you know, and being mindful in this work is important, and you're going to be doing it for a long time. And so I don't know, it just gets me real riled up.
All right.
So I hit a hot button there. That was perfect. That was
baited
like,
her and you got her, bro.
Clockwork. That's right. That's right.
All right. Here's a softball question. So,
did you know I played? No, I was so bad.
You played softball in high school?
Junior high and high school for like 3 or 4 years, like 7th grade and 10th grade maybe. And someone asked me the other day, like, you know, hand-eye coordination. I'm sure you have hand-eye coordination. Like, you played softball. You had to hit the ball. And I like just laughed. I was like, oh no. I never hit the ball. I never once hit the ball. Like, that's not. I was a really good center fielder. I just want to say that. I can catch a ball, especially if I have to, like, jump for it. Special skill set. But,
laying
like,
yourself out there for the ball. I love it.
I'm pretty much always trying to play adult baseball. So, if anyone wants to start a team, I'm looking you in the eyeball.
That's actually pretty interesting that most people want to actually be at the behind the
plate. Oh, God, no. I don't want. No, I'm good. If there was an opposite of a designated hitter, that would be me. Like, please don't make me embarrassed. That's right. Please don't make me embarrass myself.
Love it.
All right, softball question. Sorry.
Softball question. So, real world scholars, but what else do you have your hands in, or what projects are you thinking about getting into next?
Ooh, that's a good question. So, we're actually working on some new ideas that we're really excited about. The first one is tentatively called the Dew Tank. We talk to so many human beings.
Who's
in this.
We? Just your
organization? As an organization. Okay. We talk to so many human beings in this space. We're really relational. So over the past few years, you know, we've seen a lot of different cool models because we're out on the road a lot. You know, we're always kind of learning. And one theme or one model that we've seen done really well over and over again is it's essentially, you know, when educators can effectively bring community members and students together to solve community problems. So one of our favorite people, Doris Korda, runs an organization called Wildfire Education. They do this work. She did this in her classroom for years and years, and the kids would solve real problems that local businesses struggled with. Mm-hmm. Iowa Big, which is a big school in Cedar Rapids, they do this work. So we've seen it in these kind of like microcosmic ways, and it's always really formative for the community, but you know, obviously for the student as well. And so we are always asking, you know, what works and how can we make it work for everybody? So what we're going to be doing this coming year is building a technology platform that it can essentially be a clearinghouse for like local communities to bring together young people and community organizations and businesses to solve local problems, really build those relationships and create that rising tide that can float all boats. And so we're going to be piloting that this coming year and then building a piece of technology that can then be like replicated or then used to replicate that experience in other cities. And we're gonna be piloting it in Chattanooga and hopefully Kansas City. Again, coming back to like one of the reasons we love working there is because they have some previously existing communities, networks that want to work together, want to support each other. And so we're really excited about that one. Anything that dissolves the walls of the classroom that really like elevates young people as stakeholders in their communities and really values their voices, their ideas and their work is something that just gets me really excited.
Hashtag very aroused.
Hashtag very aroused.
Is that a hashtag we use?
Yes. No, it's a hashtag we use on the Educated Baron Guest podcast. Hashtag tell me more is another frequent one. These are all
I
shirts
didn't
that
we'll
be at South by Southwest when we have our booth. But
oh my gosh, this is going to be the greatest. Okay. Second one, Education Broadcasting Network. So yes. We are really excited about this, right? Like y'all are educators, you run this podcast, you know what it is like to create intentional time and space to learn, to share out loud, right? And I think over the last few years, we've learned a lot in the relationships that we have with teachers. One is that they feel disconnected. We work with people in places like High Tech High and that lone teacher in like Sioux City, Iowa, that is like looking for community, right? Like we have a whole spectrum of educators who feel super connected, super inspired, super supported, and then none of those things. On the other side of the coin, we've seen such powerful outcomes that can come when people own their stories, right? We started talking about this really with young people and the EdCorps model because, you know, all these amazing things were happening in classrooms, but they was like, oh, but we didn't make a lot of money, so we didn't talk about it, as if that was like the only story to tell. And in fact, that's like for us the least important story to tell, right? Like, you know, we had one class that or one student who wrote an article about how she had like severe social anxiety. But because having to talk to customers over and over again and like really find her voice helped her deal with that social anxiety. And the teacher intentionally put her in this space because he knew it made her so uncomfortable and she like really was like, you know, struggling with it. And so she was able to overcome those things. And to me, that's a really good story. It's a really good story to own and to understand that is way more important than like making $1,000. Like figuring out how to like, you know, speak while your voice trembles is a wild thing. And so we saw as we worked with young people that they had challenges around owning and understanding the value in their stories. We saw that educators had a hard time with the same thing, you know, and so kind of looking at all these different pieces of our work and the learnings that we had, we said like, what if there was a space where educators could share and learn out loud and reflect and connect and co-conspire, right? In ways that were authentic and vulnerable, right? Because like obviously those things happen. Those are blogs and Twitter and whatever, but like there was something about like being able to just put all your shit out there and say like, this is what I'm struggling with. You know, like I've had two teachers and then there are teachers who I adore say to me in the last like 2 or 3 months, like, you know, every week I think I need to quit. Like I'm clearly in the wrong business, but be having a space to like come and say that out loud with other educators. We just knew that there was something there. So the Education Broadcast Network is our best guess right now. And like what it looks like to create a space, for educators, for schools to celebrate one another, to share, to own, for educators to own their own learning and journeys and careers. And so we're launching that. We're building that now. We're launching that, later, summer probably. Technology,
but sounds like a potential home for the Educated Guest podcast. Or at least sleep on the couch, right?
Yeah, I think we'll be...
You probably have an air mattress for you guys. We got an air mattress. Couch,
not Airbnb, but couch surf.
I was definitely thinking of an air mattress and or futon.
Yeah. And I'm wondering, what does it look like when teachers can recognize the things that they're excited about and interested in, their own unique identities around the educational process? Like, because obviously you guys are doing this because you're interested in having these conversations and all the ways that this goes. Like, that, these are things that like obviously exist in the classroom, but also exist outside the classroom. And I'm curious and excited to learn, like, what does this look like when more educators feel empowered to do what you're doing right now? Like, what does that look like when more voices, you know, are coming out of the education space that are authentic and empowered and excited? I mean, these are the types of conversations we have around, like, what does it look like to decentralize learning just in general? Right? LRNG is doing some cool work around this, but essentially it's just, like, what happens when we, like, get rid of this, like, teacher-student narrative and we're all learners and all spaces can be learning spaces? Like, what happens when, like, learning isn't something that just happens from, like, you know, 7:30 to 3:30 and that, like, some people have a better handle on it, a.k.a. educators, you know? Like what happens when we start to, like, dissolve those preconceived ideas of how this work works? And I think it gets wild. So, like, one of the things that excites me about After School Space as well is just, like community-based learning spaces like libraries and maker spaces and whatnot is like, you know, for folks, particularly for young people who don't thrive in traditional educational settings, which is most kids, right? We're getting like viable other opportunities. And so maybe you don't love school, but like maybe you also don't need to drop out because you're having intentional learning spaces or experiences in other spaces that are letting you know that you have value.
Yeah.
And jinx. That you are smart. You owe me a root beer.
Jinx. Anyway. No, I think it's the same.
It's fun.
We're not even drunk. It's multiple answers to the same question.
Yes.
And so I appreciate that. Caesar, you said you were going to take us on a very emotional journey right now, and you were going to ask a question that was so compelling that we were going to think about.
No, I didn't say that.
My seat.
I didn't say that.
No. Caesar.
No, I just got this thing now. It's driving me wild.
Like Rihanna.
Oh.
No, that's common, actually. I got this thing now. Driving me wild. Come on.
I was actually more thinking like, when I'm with you, all I get is wild thoughts.
Oh, word?
Sorry.
hashtag very aroused.
Ooh, is there like a hashtag she went too far? Because this would now be
so
appropriate.
I noticed that you, I noticed on Twitters that you just recently retweeted something about Rhapsody, and there was a list of MCs. I didn't know you was a hip-hop person at all. I was kind of worried that we were going to...
have to not ask that question?
ooh. Fuck with hip-hop?
I do.
Give me some of your go-to MCs. I'm not asking you for your top five, but throughout your life, who you be listening to?
Top five MCs would be great, but
that is
another question you can answer is.
I'll say this: I have commitment issues. So when you say something like that, that's like something I'm like, oh, cool. I'll get back to you next Sunday. I really got to like make a list. I got to like call it down. We need to do some upvoting. I really want to make sure I answer this properly. So I think about like formatively. My first CD when I was 7 was a Tupac CD.
A
in
word?
Retrospect, I'm like, what were my parents thinking? Like what? Like
totally okay, totally,
totally fine, totally
which
fine.
Which one? Which CD?
I was Greatest Hits. I was 7, so I wasn't like nuanced yet. I know.
He's got a Greatest Hits CD.
I think it came out.
Yeah, he does. I thought it was strictly for my. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what
yeah.
I thought it was. But what?
Tupacalypse.
Tupacalypse.
No,
a Greatest Hits. I'll take it.
And then after Pac?
In terms of CD order, because I actually think I got the Pocahontas soundtrack after.
No. Just
sorry,
your MCs
sorry,
that
sorry,
you love
I had
to listen to.
You know, so Rodrigo asked me earlier, like, what do I listen to? And I told him how, like, I kind of go in these, like, long stints.
Yeah.
And I had 5 CDs in my car for the entirety of my college career.
Yeah.
5. Wow. One of them was a Kid Cudi album.
That's okay.
Second one. Okay, go ahead.
Was that rough for you?
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. We'll tell you the story afterwards.
Yeah.
Okay, another one's like a John Legend CD. Another one's an NDRE CD. One was a Sublime's.
No.
NDRE
is good too.
She's the greatest. I just want her heart beating inside my chest. Just think about that for 1 minute. Okay.
That's emotional. That's emotional.
It is.
Sublime and Kid Cudi.
Listen to Kid Cudi a lot as like a late teens, early, I guess it's probably like 19 to 24.
Early college.
Yep. All of college, probably.
All of college. So that's Man in the Moon then, it has to be, right?
Yep. That album is the one. You should also know, all of my friends hated me because they're like, we can't listen to this shit anymore.
Throw that shit on repeat. Loop it. Loop it. I want to hear that shit again.
Now, when we were on break, you did mention that you had recently went to a Nas and Lauryn Hill concert. So you a fan of Lauryn or Nas?
More so Lauryn and the Fugees. I mean, I love Nas. Everyone loves Nas. But like, I was a big Fugees fan as a kid. To date, I still listen to like the Fugees pretty regularly. Okay. They are on my
pre-nervous breakdown, Lauryn, or post-nervous breakdown, Lauryn.
Ooh.
Too soon?
No, not too soon.
Not
at
too
all.
Soon. It's, no, way, no, it's, no, it's not been too past.
Soon. Did they make you wait, or were they on time?
That is a great question. It's hard to tell. You know, I don't.
She goes, I may or may not remember those details, finer details.
Oh, that's where we're going.
No, I...
That's cool. You had a good time.
It was fun. It was great. You know, it's hard to see Lauryn Hill in concert now. She's obviously a very talented vocalist and lyricist, but because she doesn't, you know, she can't perform her own music publicly, she does all these, like, remixes that are... It's kind of hard to track.
Wait a minute. Explain that. Why can't she record?
She doesn't own. She doesn't own the rights to them.
That's some fucked up shit.
It's fucked, dude. You should learn more about this. The studio that she was with. I think a lot of folks feel like she really got like bamboozled, and so she can't even perform like originals of her own music, which is awful, right? Because her like Lauryn Hill gives me life, right?
But this education was so dope.
It was dope.
Yeah, yes.
And she can't perform those.
Can't perform. So she can perform like those songs. Totally redone, but like it sucks though, because like half the time you're 2/3 of the way through the song and you're like, wait, oh, I guess I kind of recognize those lyrics, but you didn't know that, you couldn't hear that, right? You can't sing along because like often the rhythm is totally different, like it's a totally different song. So it's a little heartbreaking to see her in concert.
Just to wrap this up, another pin tweet here, trust your dopeness.
Oh yeah.
Tell me what's up.
I keep wanting to get that tattooed, and every person is like, please don't do that to your body.
My wife has the shirt, so we got to get you the
I don't
shirt.
Know where it came from originally. I have no idea where it
we'll
came from.
We'll give that. We'll give it, friends of the podcast. Hashtag friends of the podcast.
Trust your dopeness. When I came across that, it's like a retweet of somebody else's, like mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. Lisa Palmieri. And when I came across that, that was like, those are the words like on the inside of my human, right? Is like, I talk a lot about superpowers, and it's one of the only ways that I feel like I can effectively communicate that, like, I just truly in my bones believe that, like, we all have these innate and unique superpowers that we bring to the table, and so much of the world is trying to take that from you. It's trying to tell you that, like, you need to put those in a box or that they're not helpful here, right? Like, how often are we, like, socializing young people in ways that say, like, oh, like, you have all this energy, you're talking too much, we'll stop that. Well, if that kid's like very talented in certain ways, like rather than trying to like call those behaviors so that you can manage them better, mm-hmm. right? Because that's what we're doing often, is we're just right. trying to like condition them so that we can manage human beings better. Like we're having them cut those things off, and there's something like I'm picturing puzzle pieces that we're like kind of, and we're making them all squares. They could have all fit together before, but we're making them all squares, and sure they still fit
ooh.
Together.
Ooh. That's definitely going on a meme or something.
Well, right? Come up with something good.
You fucks
with
dope. It.
That's dope.
All right, man. I'm going to dish the rock, Rodrigo. Put a bow on this, baby.
Yeah, let's. If there's one ask now, we're going to wrap up the podcast. Thank you so much for being on here. But is there an ask for our listeners? Like, what is there? We'll definitely go check you out on them Twitters.
Okay, so this is... Yeah, this is fun. Okay, at Liz Burden in another life. I went by Liz.
L-Y-Z?
L-Y-Z. I'm gonna digress. In the sixth grade, I went to a new school, and my name is Elise, and during the first, I went from, like, an elementary school to a middle school, so it was my first time with, like, you know, classes that weren't just, like, one teacher, and so they said, I'm gonna go through roll, it's the first class, and if you go by something else at the end, tell me, you know, the teacher said that, and I'm Elise Burden, so I'm, like, usually pretty close to the top, but there was another Elise, and she had an A last name, and I'd never been in class with, like, another Elise, and so she said Elise, and then I was like, oh, well, this is a new school, all these people know each other, I don't know these people, right, and so I just started, like, playing with my name, like, the next, like, 5 minutes while she called roll, and at the very end, she was like, okay, so, like, does anyone go by nicknames, and I just raised my hand, I was like, I go by Liz. And like just from that day forward, I did not even a little bit. Yeah, so I'm, in a lot of parts of my life, I am still Liz. Like people, like college, whatever. So Liz, L-Y-Z, Burden, it's, and my grown-up name is Elise. But the ask, I just recently, you know, Rodrigo, you and I were talking about this just a few minutes ago, but like, so much of this work, so much of the best work happens in the in-between times, right? It's not like in the professional development session, right? It's like, it's in the bar after South By where we're all unpacking the things that blew our minds or the convictions we had, the reflections, whatever, right? It's the in-between times where you can kind of just like settle things down with no expectation to be human and grow together. And so knowing that and knowing that like that gives me so much life, I recently added a calendar link for my like calendar, automator, Calendly, whatever. And you know, there's like, you know, 30-minute call, 60-minute call, but there's a new event type. It's called the Think and Drink. And I put that on there for people to book time to like do this with me. Because I do it with like a lot of friends and colleagues, like let's just jam, let's jump on a Skype call for an hour and have a glass of wine and talk about what, you know, Mike Strong says, build, bash, beautify. Right? And that those are some three other words that could go on my insides, you know? And it's like, and I want to have that conversation with like, if any of this resonated with anyone, like, let's jump on a Think and Drink. Let's just have some unstructured time to talk about what do you want to build, bash, or beautify?